Hey, this is Gillian Welch.
And this is Dave Rawlings.
And you're listening to Off the Record.
I'm Brian Wise. Thank you very much for joining me on the program this week, where I've got a couple of special guests for you. First, I'm going to be talking to UK folk legend Shirley Collins about her latest album, Heart's Ease. And later in the program, we'll talk to Stuart Coop about his brand new biography of Paul Kelly, which has just been published in Australia by Hachette and is now available. We'll have an in-depth conversation with Stuart. But first to Shirley Collins, who began her career in British folk music back in the 50s. She worked with Alan Lomax after she met him in England. She travelled to America researching American folk music. She recorded a number of solo albums. She was married a couple of times, once to Ashley Hutchins, the renowned folk musician in the UK, but she lost her voice for 38 years. She was unable to sing. She recorded a comeback album, Lodestar, in 2016, and she just released a brand new album called Heart's Ease. So let's catch up. In part one of our interview special, I'll play part two for you next week, but part one this week with Shirley Collins.
Hi, Shirley. How are you?
Hi, Brian. Hi. I'm sort of fine, thanks.
Happy birthday for last Sunday.
Oh, thank you. It was really rather a wonderful day, as it turned out, because Morris, Eamon danced in the street and they did three dances outside my cottage. And I love Morris dancing, and it was just so lovely to see them. And to be, I mean, they were properly distanced up and down the road, and I had a few friends. And it was just a wonderful day. Really cheered me up.
Great. I was going to ask you a little bit later on, but I might as well mention it now. You appeared on one of the most influential folk albums of all time, a few of them actually, but one of them was actually called Morris On, wasn't it, with Richard Thompson, Dave Maddox and others many years ago?
That's right. Well, yeah. It was a great album. I loved it.
Yeah, and very influential, and introduced a lot of people to sort of not only the music, but the sort of style of dancing that we probably would have missed.
Well, that's very true. No, I think it was a great achievement, actually. And as you say, it's lively and sometimes very beautiful, you know, tunes. It was fun.
Now,
I think that's one of Ashley's great achievements, really, making that album.
It was, and it was groundbreaking. And a lot of people who followed you and those artists were, you know, sort of introduced, as I said, to things that we might never have got to hear otherwise, and particularly that style, really, wasn't it?
Well, no, that's very true. And I don't know if you know Sidney Morris. Sidney has a Morris side. And I don't know if they were influenced by that album, but I do remember when I've only been to Australia once, and that was back in 1980. And when Pete Bellamy and I got off the plane at Sydney Airport, the Morris men were there in the concourse to greet us and to dance for us. And it was just such a wonderful surprise. It just started the whole thing off so beautifully.
Oh,
And the pretty primrose decks the earth.
Then to the maypole haste away, for 'tis now a holiday. Then to the maypole haste away, for 'tis now a holiday.
Hello everyone, this is Shirley Collins and I'm calling from England on Off the Record.
Now let's talk about your new album, which is coming out. In fact, it's your second album for Domino following Lodestar, which was your first album for 38 years. So two albums in 4 years. That's some kind of gap, but there is a very good reason for it, wasn't there?
Well, yes, I lost my voice all that time. I just could not sing. I completely couldn't sing at all, and not even to myself indoors. And I had to find, you know, other ways of making a living. And I wasn't sure. I didn't think I would ever be able to sing again. But I loved the music so much that I started to do talks about it, you know, illustrated talks with recordings, field recordings and pictures. And that sort of got me back in the swing of being back on stage. But even so, singing again hadn't crossed my mind. But David Tibet, who is current 93, came to see me one day quite a few years back when I lived in Brighton, and said I was one of his two favourite singers. And I thought, oh, that's lovely. I said, who's the other one? He said, Tiny Tim. I wasn't quite sure how to take this. But he kept encouraging me, trying to make me sing, and indeed I did sing sort of a couple of verses of a nursery rhyme and later a hymn on one of his albums, which wasn't very good, and it still didn't sort of make me feel that I could do it. And he kept asking me if I'd go to one of his concerts and just sing one or two songs, and I kept saying no. I mean, this was over years, you know, it lasted some years. And then one day he said, look, I've got a concert at the Union Chapel in London, a lovely venue. He said, just come and sing two songs and then go home. And I was so fed up with saying no, I said yes. And I took Ian Keary with me, who is the music director of the new album and of Lodestar as well, and an old friend, so I felt very comfortable with him. And we went on and we did two songs. So that broke the ice.
Your inability to sing, that was a physical condition, wasn't it? It wasn't just something that you were scared to sing.
It was a physical condition. Linda Thompson had the same problem.
Exactly.
And, you know, we've had long conversations about it. I think it's partly psychological, because there was nothing wrong with me physically. It was just in my head. I was just too scared to even attempt to open my mouth and sing.
I've heard of people getting stage fright, but I haven't. I do know Linda not being able to do it, but it's great that you now have a brand new career at this stage of your life.
I know, who'd have believed it?
Well,
but no, it's lovely, and I just really enjoy singing to people because I can talk about the songs as well, and you know, tell them about the songs and sing them, and we just, you know, they're lovely concerts. They seem to go down really well, and it's just great. It's great for me, and I think it's also good for the music as well, because there aren't many of us who stick to traditional songs all the time, you know.
You know, you, as I said, you've got a new career at this stage of your life. That young fellow, Bob Dylan, he's just had a number one album, so it's all happening, isn't it?
I haven't heard it yet, but it's got fantastic reviews, hasn't it?
It has. It looks like you've got to be over 75 years of age to have a number one album on the charts these days, so you're in good company there.
Yeah, well, I don't think even though I'm 10 years over the 75 years of age, I don't think I'm going to have a hit album. But it's just great to have another one out anyway.
There was a little ship and she sailed on the sea. The name of the ship was the Mary Golden Tree. Sailing on the low and lonesome low, sailing on the lonely lowland sea. They hadn't been out scarce days two or three before they sighted the British robbery. Sailing on the low and lonesome low, flaunting the Jolly Roger on the lowland sea. Up jumps the captain, a wringing of his hands, and he cries, "Oh Lord, and what will we do? She'll sink us in the low and lonesome low, sink us to the bottom of the lowland sea." Up and spoke the little cabin boy, says, "What will you give me if I them destroy? If I sink them in the low and lonesome low, sink them to the bottom of the lowland sea. Well, I'll give you gold and I'll give you fee, my youngest daughter, and you shall married be. If you sink them in the low and lonesome low, sink them to the bottom of the lowland sea."
Hello, everyone. This is Shirley Collins, and I'm calling from England on Off the Record.
You said that you felt Lodestar was a little bit tentative. How do you feel about the new album?
I think it's much better. It sounds more confident. I mean, making Lodestar was really such an experiment, you know, and we had to do it very slowly and patiently. And because I didn't dare go into a studio to record it, I thought, you know, no studio engineer will understand either the songs or this old girl singing them, you know. I couldn't trust anybody. So we did record it at home in my cottage in Sussex. And it was a great, great experience. But quite, I mean, you know, we were having to sort of rush out the front door all the time to stop the kids skateboarding down the road for 10 minutes while we recorded a song, or, you know, wait until the train rumbled past or an airplane flew overhead or kids out playing. I mean, it was fun. And just to be surrounded by, you know, the people who I do have as the musicians on both albums is lovely to be in their company, because we're all such good friends as well. And I can trust them implicitly with the music. You know, they absolutely know the right thing to do.
Well, that album,
On both albums, you know, it's been a real pleasure. And I just feel I'm Shirley Collins again, because for all the years when I wasn't singing, I didn't feel it was really me.
Yeah, it would be like a part of your personality was missing, wouldn't it, I imagine?
Mm, yeah, it's true. It was a strange time.
Well, it's wonderful that you were able to come back. And as we said, the new album, Heartsease, unlike the last one, I think you went into the studio to do this, didn't you?
I did, and I really enjoyed it. it felt, you know, it felt more professional, of course, it felt proper. And the engineer there, Al Scott, was an old friend of Ian Keary's, who does all the arrangements. They'd both been in the Oyster Band together, Ian some years ago, and Al Scott still is. So they knew each other, they knew the music, they understood. And Al Scott was just so patient with me, which was lovely. But no, it was fun in the studio. And of course, you can rely on getting the very best sound as well. No, it was. I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed it this time.
Well, obviously, your voice has changed over the decades. You're happy with it now? It sounds sort of rich and warm. And
well, you have to accept it. It's not, you know, the higher voice I had when I was a young singer. It's gone. It's much lower. And I mean, so when Lodestar came out, one reviewer said I sounded like Tom Waits. somebody on Facebook said, "Oh, the bitch can't sing." You know, he said, "But you just laugh at those and go on." So no, this time I feel my voice is a bit stronger, but it's lower. You know, there's nothing I can do about that. It's the voice I have now, and you know, people seem to accept it. They don't expect anything else really. But what I do know I can do, Brian, is I understand the songs. And just trust the songs, you know, what you're doing is telling the story, passing the songs on. And I think I still think I've got the ability to do that, to tell that story.
Father, Father, build me a boat that on the ocean I'll go and float, and every kingship that do pass by, there I'll inquire for my sailor boy. I hadn't been sailing but half an hour before I met a bold man of war. Captain, tell me true, is my sweet William on board with you? No, kind lady, he's not here. That he is drowned most breaks my fear. The other night when the wind blew high, that's when you lost your sweet sailor boy. I'll set me down, I'll write a song. I'll write it neat and I'll write it long. In every verse I will shed a tear. In every line, oh sweet William dear.
Folk legend Shirley Collins, a mere 85 years of age. And we were talking to Shirley about her latest album, Heartsease, and we heard a couple of tracks from it, Tell Me True and The Merry Golden Tree. And we also heard from the Morris On album, Staines Morris, featuring Richard Thompson, Ashley Hutchins, Dave Maddox, and more. And Shirley Collins on vocals. Of course, that album released back in 1972, a real legendary folk album. You're listening to Off the Record with Brian Wise. Thanks for joining me this week. And our feature interview this week is with Stuart Coop. He's a renowned music journalist, author, and broadcaster. In fact, if you live in Sydney, you'll probably hear him a couple of times a week on community radio up there. His last book was enormously successful, titled Roadies. It was a terrific tribute to the unsung heroes of the Australian music scene. But for his latest one, he's chosen, well, a very well-sung hero of Australian music, Paul Kelly, subtitled The Man, the Music, and the Life in Between. It chronicles the entire life of Paul Kelly, and there's lots of very interesting detail in there that you perhaps wouldn't have found in Paul Kelly's own autobiography published some years ago. This is a very, very fine book, and I caught up with Stuart to talk about the book, and we also will hear some music from Paul Kelly's career. And I haven't chosen all obvious tracks. I've chosen a few of my favourites from Paul Kelly's earlier career. Stuart Coop on his book, Paul Kelly, The Man, The Music and The Life in Between. On a technical note, Stuart, just to start with, how long did it take and how many interviews did you actually do?
Look, Brian, it took about 2 years. I'm not going to pretend I worked, 14 hours a day every day, although it felt like it over the last 6 to 8 months. I ended up doing roughly 100 interviews. I made a decision early on that I wanted it to all be new material. I wanted to talk to as many people as I could who had been and have been involved in the creative side of Paul Kelly's world. You know, I don't believe that art is created in a vacuum. A lot of people, have input and involvement. And I also didn't want to regurgitate secondary sources. So I decided I was just going to do new interviews. I didn't go back and reread Paul's book, How to Make Gravy. I started Googling and printing up copies of the millions of stories that have been written about Paul. Then I just put them aside and I thought, you know what? I'm just going to talk to everyone and out of that's going to come the book. So I ended up tracking down, every surviving member of the high-rise bombers, every surviving dot, coloured girls, everyone who's played with Paul since. But of course, I found some people that played with him in his early Adelaide bands, the debutantes. And towards the very end of the book, I was told about a band that Paul played in that he named Good Enough for the Bush, who, as referenced in the song Adelaide, did play a show underneath the statue of Colonel Light. So all the musicians, I talked to Kev Carmody, Archie Roach, Renee Geyer, Willie Vlaughton, Steve Earle, Deborah Conway, Michael Gudinski. I tracked down Michelle Higgins, who was very pivotal to Paul's career when he was at Mushroom Records. She's living in New York these days. I talked to David Frick about a bigger perspective on Paul. So Neil Finn, Don Walker, lots and lots of people.
Now, how did you convince Paul that there should be a biography of him when he'd already had his own memoir, if you will, out there? Did he need convincing, or it didn't matter, you were going to do it anyway? But
no, I wasn't going to do it anyway, Brian. I mean, if he was completely opposed to a book being written, I don't think I really wanted to do it. I really set out wanting him not to get in the way and not to tell people that he didn't want a book. So I approached Bill Cullen, his current manager, about 4 years ago, and nothing would happen. And every 6 months, I'd send another email to Bill Cullen, and nothing would happen. And then after my Roadies book came out, I became a little bit more serious about it. And I thought I was well placed to write the book because Paul was the very first interview I did in Adelaide in 1977. I did manage him from post through gossip, under the sun and so much water. And I thought, well, anyone can do a book about Paul Kelly. They could just go to Wikipedia and Google and churn out a book. And I thought, it's kind of only a matter of time until somebody does that. And it went backwards and forwards. And eventually I called Bill Cullen up and I said, any movement? And he said, yes, I mentioned it to Paul the other day. And I said, how did that go? And he said, he rolled his eyes. And I said, that's not a no, is it? And he said, no, it's not a no. I said, that's kind of a good sign, isn't it? And he said, it's a good sign. So Paul asked for a page of how I would approach, you know, what I wanted to do with the book. I did that in a couple of minutes, and that was sent to him. And then it came back with Paul saying, look, this actually seems pretty interesting. And then Bill called up and said, I'm not sure I believe we're having this conversation, but Paul has said to go ahead with his blessing and that he will agree to be interviewed at the end of the project. So that was really what I wanted. The fact that, you know, as you would expect, Brian, Paul being Paul, anyone that I approached was probably, for the most part, going to call him up and say, hey, are you good with this book? You know, are you happy with me talking to Stuart? So I wanted him to be okay on that level. And that's really how it proceeded for about, you know, 20 months until we got together. It was kind of interesting because we worked together during the 80s, and then we met up at a radio station. I was doing an interview with him just after the new version of Songs from the South had come out, and he was out doing some publicity for the anthology of poetry that he'd assembled. And when he walked in to do the interview, I was well advanced on the book. He knew all the people that I was talking to, but he and I had not actually exchanged a word or seen each other, except me being in the audience at gigs, for 22 years. Mm. It was a really long period, not because we had any sort of falling out when we stopped working. That was all fine. It's just like we didn't move in the same circles. And so it was kind of, I think we were both like characters in To Her Door, you know, going, how is it going to work out? You know, would we get on well? Would we recognize each other? And that was good. And Paul was very generous with his time. He kept, you know, volunteering time, and he knew I was going right back to that period of, you know, the late 70s, early 80s, you know, the period of Talk and Manila and prior to that, you know, those records that he has had removed from circulation. So he knew I was delving deep into some things that he really doesn't seem particularly keen to talk about. And then he kept saying, you know, do you want to do another session? Would you like to do another session? And at one point I said, you know, if you're getting sick of this, we can stop. And he said, no, he gave me that, you know, that Paul Kelly grin. And he said, no, it's kind of fun sitting with you, trying to, you know, piece together all the things that happened over those years. So it was a good relationship. It wasn't and isn't an authorized book. I didn't want to write an authorized book. I wanted to be free to have my own take on all aspects of his career. I did offer him the opportunity to read it towards the end, and I was, of course, crazily nervous. You know, him having written his own book, he's intellectually, you know, rigorous. And he, you know, he sent me a nice note saying that thanking me for that, and he said he didn't expect to like it all. He said, if I do, you haven't done your job. And so I thought that was nice. But I was phenomenally nervous. My stomach resembled a washing machine in spin mode on the afternoon when my phone lit up and there was the initials PK there. So I thought, okay, I'm about to find out whether I've got a subject who is pleased, ambivalent, or, of course, your worst nightmare, you know, is actively antagonistic about something that you've done.
I'm drag me back again.
Listening to Off the Record, I'm talking to Stuart Coop about his Paul Kelly biography, The Man, the Music, and the Life in Between. So, what do you think that you brought to the general readers and fans that his book didn't? I know what I think, but what were you aiming to do that wasn't already out there in a myriad of articles and Paul's own book? What did you want to do?
I wanted to fill in a lot of the gaps. I mean, Paul's memoir was his book. It was long, big, detailed, but it was his story, and it concentrated on the things that he wanted to write about. And as I read it way back, you know, 10 years ago, I realized that there was a lot of information in there, and there was a lot that wasn't in there. So part of it was that, but more importantly, I wanted to piece together the world that he came from. I wanted to talk to all of those people that have played with him and give. I mean, I guess the one thing that my book has that his book, by the very nature of his book, doesn't have is everybody else's voice. So I wanted all of those people that have been engaged with him over the course of more than 40 years to talk to me about what it was like being in the studio with him, what it was like having been on tour with him, what it was like sitting around when songs were being written, what it was like being on the road. You know, all of that, that sort of stuff. That's really what I was trying to get. So I was hoping, and this will be for others to decide, Brian. But I was hoping that I'd get a book that would sit very comfortably alongside Here's How to Make Gravy, so that people would go, okay, when it comes to, we need Paul's book, and we need this book that talks to and about all of the other things. There's a little bit of overlap, but I don't think there's an incredible amount. You know, it's surprising that you can write a book the length of mine, and he can write the book as long as book his was. And, you know, there's not too many stories and overlaps in the two books, or at least I think so.
Well, you deal in detail with some of the lesser known aspects about his life, some of the things he hasn't spoken about publicly, some of the things that were not dealt with in the documentary about him for obvious reasons. Was there a problem with that? I mean, I'm talking about the drug use, which just comes up quite often in the book, obviously.
No, I mean, Paul had outed himself and his drug use in How to Make Gravy. I guess my book has quite a significantly more about those years, because I am talking to all of the participants and all of the other people that were around him. Look, I was, as always, I'm mindful when I'm researching books like this. I'm getting, I think, pretty good at self-censoring and going, what actually aids and helps tell the story, and what is just, you know, in some cases, you know, more or less innuendo, which may or may not be true, but doesn't serve anybody by being repeated or being put out there in the public domain. So, and also I know how to spell defamation, and my books are, you know, my books are very, very carefully and heavily legal to, I'm touching wood as I say this, Brian, to avoid such issues. So look, you know, no, I didn't want to hold back in terms of writing about that period of Paul's life. And look, he did comment to me that he found reading that portion of the book quite confronting for him and quite hard going, and in a sort of, you know, strange sort of way, that made me pleased, because it made me feel like, you know, probably I had got to the real essence of what his world was like at that time and what it was like to be in the high-rise bombers or Paul Kelly and the Dots, and, you know, and also existing, you know, it's in those days, it's a very Melbourne tale. You know, Paul uproots from Adelaide, you know, comes across to Melbourne in the late 70s. He moves into a now, you know, maybe the National Trust should put some caveat over, a house in Hoddle Street in East Melbourne where all of the people from Spain Ange were living, you know, John Dowler and Chris Langman and Chris Dyson. You know, Martin Armiger says that he used to drop around there, or told me, you know, because we did a long interview before Martin sadly passed away. You know, Bleeding Heart used to rehearse in a semi-soundproof front room at this two-story house in Hoddle Street. So you know, I was really trying to capture, you know, what the scene was like in those days. You know, I must admit I wasn't aware of, say, that, you know, the divide between those people that sort of hung out around Carlton and the so-called Carlton scene and the more blues-based rootsy people that hung out around the Station Hotel, and then a little bit later the emerging punk scene in St Kilda. So, you know, I'm trying to paint a, you know, a broader picture too of the world that he was in at the time, and all of the other bands, the competitiveness, and what he was going through, you know, trying to talk about how, you know, he was learning to be a band leader, he was learning to play electric music, you know, he was hanging around with people that he said, you know, were like gods to him, you know, and in particular he was talking about Martin Armiger, and, you know, we worked out that Martin was only 5 years older than Paul, but, you know, had been around and had such a, you know, mythic figure in Melbourne even then, and Paul just said, golly, you know, like these young gods are like playing in my band, and so, you know, I've tried to get that, the feel of all of that in this book.
Sun and the moon.
Bowie out front of the Dots from the very early 80s and a version of the song Lowdown. And we've been talking to Stuart Coop in part one of our interview special about Stuart's book, Paul Kelly, The Man, The Music and The Life In Between. The other song we heard during that segment, Adelaide from the Gossip album with the Coloured Girls, released back in 1986. Let's return to our interview with Stuart Coop about Paul Kelly.
Hi, it's Paul Kelly here. You're listening to Off The Record.
Stuart, your outline of that particular era of Paul's life, it gives a lot of context into his music and into what he became later on. But one of the features of his personality that comes through in the book is, and many people remark upon this, is his ability, and it's something that he shares with Bob Dylan and Neil Young, is his ability to move on from bands and relationships.
Yep. I mean, you know, you would have to say that, you know, looking at Paul's career, there's, you know, there's a fair bit of collateral damage along the way. And that's not ever the result of nastiness or unpleasantness. You're absolutely right. I mean, he emerges to me and did emerge even more as I spent these couple of years really thinking about him as right from the get-go. He's been very single-minded, extremely focused and extremely determined with where he wanted to be and how he was going to get there, and more restless than I'd realized, you know, because I mean, when I was with him, you know, it was still the Coloured Girl stroke Messengers, and I wasn't really that involved at the end when he parted way with that band, which surprised a lot of people. But again, you know, so did Bruce Springsteen parting ways with the E Street Band. People were going, what is he doing? What's going on here? And, you know, there's a lot of people, myself included, that wish Neil Young would have just stuck with Crazy Horse. But, you know, Paul is restless. He does want to move on. And when I really thought about the changes that came about with different bands, I'd never thought, because we talked at one point about his great love for reggae, and you know, and he was listening to reggae since the 1970s, and it's quite a prevalent influence on the Manila record. And then, you know, he said to me that there was no reggae influences in the Coloured Girls stroke Messengers, and I said, why was that? And he said, well, you know, Steve Connolly hated reggae, so you know, and so that's, and so when he parted ways with the Messengers, you know, it freed him up to do things like, you know, actually the record that I probably listened to most during the writing of this book was the Professor Ratbaggy album, which, you know, is his, you know, excursion into the dub and reggae and funk, and a record that, in all honesty, I hadn't listened to all that much when it did come out, and then I went back and I thought, this is actually one of the more intriguing records of Paul Kelly's career, and it's one where his name is not on the front cover, and possibly a lot of Paul Kelly fans, unless they're fairly hardcore, maybe don't even know that it's a Paul Kelly record. But yes, he wants to keep moving. He's in a position now where he has a whole array of people that he can call on for different projects. But yeah, he's restless, and when he's ready to move, sometimes I get the feeling that sometimes he doesn't even know where he wants to go, but he knows he doesn't want to stay where he is at this point in time. And, you know, with the Messengers, there was a couple of years when you really sensed that, you know, he was trying to work out what artist he wanted to be, you know, even where he wanted to be. He was going backwards and forwards to North America, and he changed record labels, you know, and there was that period of, you know, as I said, messing around with Professor Ratbaggy. There were country, you know, bluegrass records. There were little bits and pieces. So all along, it's been, you know, he's been calling the shots. As I think Peter Luscombe said, he is the final say guy. And of course, you know, he's the guy that writes the songs, and he's the guy who sings them. But there is, you know, there is a ferocious determination lurking there, and it's whatever musicians and people around him that he needs for where he's going. You know, he calls his current array of musicians the squad, and it is a little bit like, you know, a footy team in that, you know, he will sit down and go, okay, this is our third home and away game. It's going to be more rock and roll. I need these people in my team. Okay, this is a more quieter, more acoustic-based record. Okay, I'm going to the squad. Who am I going to pick? Look, that's a bit cliche, but that's kind of – it's kind of how it works, and he's in that position. He's earned it, and so that's how he operates. But his approach to making music is very much like, you know, Dylan, Neil Young. You could throw in Prince and a whole bunch of other people there, in that they are distinctive artists because they have a singular career path that they want to pursue, and they accept and acknowledge that along the way, they're probably going to lose some fans, pick up some new ones. Some people will drift off for a while, then they'll come back. But the consideration of audience is secondary to the consideration of the creative output.
Something's frying on the floor below. I'm leaning out my window. Sky's on fire, the streets all aglow. Somebody's singing to the radio. I would jump from the 16th floor if I only could get next to you. Put my head in a lion's jaw if I only could get next to you. I'm walking the floor, I'm climbing the walls. I wake up from dreaming, that's when I fall. I would jump from the 16th floor if I only could get next to you. Put my head in a lion's jaw if I only could get next to you. Take a ride on a wrecking ball, yes I would, darling. Every day I speak your name, if I had wings I'd fly. You're not here to hold me. I would jump from the 16th floor. 16th floor. Put my head in a lion's jaw. I'd walk on burning coal. I'd sell my. Yes, I would. Every day I speak your name. If I had wings, I'd fly. There's no one here to hold me. Yes.
the Record, my guest is Stuart Coop, talking about his biography of Paul Kelly, subtitled The Man, the Music and the Life in Between. Well, he had a few key relationships, musical relationships in his life from way back to his teenage years. So let's just talk about maybe at least one of them. And you mentioned Steve Connolly, who was really important to him for a long time there, wasn't he?
Look, Steve was, and I hope I give my, you know, his dues in this book. I mean, I think Steve emerges as a very, very pivotal figure in Paul's emergence, as he should. And, you know, they were an interesting, you know, I was around for a lot of their dynamic, and Steve was the guy who would stand up to Paul. And he would argue his position on a song, on a chord, on a riff, on a tour schedule, anything he felt like arguing about, and that, you know, that he felt strongly about. And he would argue and put his point forward. And Paul listened to him, you know, and listened to him probably as much as he's listened to anyone else that he's played with. And you know, Paul is very open in the book about his praise for Steve, you know, that Steve, you know, taught him to cut the flab out of a lot of songs, you know, taught him brevity, taught him, you know, that some songs could be simple. You know, he says Steve Connolly turned him onto ABBA, and you know, because Steve used to argue that ABBA was really great, and Paul was dismissive, and then they ended up going off to see quite frequently an ABBA tribute band together because they both really dug it. But you know, yeah, look, Steve was an incredibly, you know, inventive and understated guitar player, and pretty much all of the post messengers musicians who have played with Paul, you know, they all talk about those messengers records and their great love and how those guitar lines of Steve Connolly's are just so essential and intrinsic to those songs that they don't dare mess with them. You know, they play Steve Connolly's parts like, you know, classical musicians would go out and play, you know, the charts of, you know, so they are so respectful of what Steve Connolly, you know, contributed to so many of the records that, you know, are still frequently, you know, they're the cornerstones of Paul Kelly's live shows to this day. You know, those records that he made in the 1980s are very, very still important. You know, you go and see a Paul show and, you know, the moment he hits Before Too Long, To Her Door, 40 Miles to Saturday Night, you know, we could both go on and on. You know, those great classic songs of the 1980s. And Steve Connolly was a pivotal force in all of those recordings, and you mentioned early Paul. I forgot to answer you on Paul's domestic world. Look, yeah, that has been explored, you know, in fair detail, particularly in Stories of Me, the you know, Ian Darling's documentary about Paul. I spoke to some of the significant partners at length for this book, and two of them were, you know, reluctant to talk, you know, and I was respectful of that. You know, I didn't spend a lot of time trying to work out, you know, who was the muse for this particular song, you know, who this song was written about. That's for Paul to know and for other people to speculate on, and not really for me to tell you, so, 'cause I don't really know. Finally,
Steve Connolly and his band The Usual Suspects, and an album that they recorded many years ago. Unfortunately, Steve passed away some years ago, but he used to be a terrific guitarist with Paul Kelly's Colour Girls and Messengers, and that's a track titled Over Me. You can find that Steve Connolly album on Bandcamp. And we also heard Song from the 16th Floor, written by Paul Kelly and John Clifford, from the Wanted Man album, one of my favourite Paul Kelly songs. And we've been talking to Stuart Coop about his biography of Paul Kelly. It's available now, subtitled The Man, The Music and The Life in Between. Thoroughly recommended. It is a terrific read. Thanks for joining me on Off the Record this week. It's been great to be with you. I hope you can keep safe. I hope you can join me next week on the program, which is brought to you on the satellite network of the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia and supported by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. I'll talk to you next week.
Outside.